Okay, brethren, I usually speak fairly regularly about the topic of faith, at least I thought I did, because faith is one of the key parts of a believer's life, but it looks like it may have slipped off the radar a wee bit, because I think it's nearly 4 years since I last spoke, strangely enough, on the topic of faith. I know I've touched on it from time to time, but not in any great detail, it would seem, so we're probably a wee bit overdue for looking at this particular topic, because, you know, we probably already know walking by faith and living by faith is somewhat different to the way that you and I usually live. Most of us are blessed with five physical senses. We can see, we can hear, we can touch, taste, we can smell, and these are often referred to as the five gateways whereby information comes into our brain. And depending on what we see or what we hear or touch, feel or smell, we'll take, you know, relevant action. If you're walking down the pavement or the sidewalk and you hear a screeching noise of brakes and tires screaming, you look up and there's a vehicle hurtling towards you, hopefully you'll take action. Your physical senses will alert you to danger and you'll hopefully move out the way. And that's how we live safely. We rely upon our five physical senses, the five gateways for information to reach our brain. And if we lose a sense or two, then yeah, to some extent, we would be handicapped. People who are blind, who are deaf, who perhaps lose the ability to taste, they have, you know, some difficulties. They can't be quite as efficient as those who've got use of all five senses. And the five physical senses are, you know, clearly a God-given blessing to us. But they do come, in a sense, with a potential danger, because not everything that exists out there can be detected by our five physical senses. Our five senses only relate to the physical realm. But there's also, of course, a spiritual realm. And in some ways, the spiritual realm is more real than the physical realm. We know there's God, who is a spirit. We know there are angels. And we don't often see them. Perhaps we've never seen an angel. There are other various types of heavenly creatures. There are demons and principalities and powers and so on. There is a heavenly temple. There is a heavenly altar. There is the throne of grace. There's many things out there that we don't physically see. They're invisible to our eyes, but they are real, very real. There's things that we can't hear out there, but they're still very real. Conversations taking place in heaven. Conversations between angels, between demons. We don't hear those things, but they are very, very real. There are things that you and I cannot detect with our touch. We can't sense them with our noses, but they are still very real. And if we're going to go through our lives depending 100% only on what we can see or hear or touch or taste or smell, we'll be cut off from the bigger and more real world out there, the spirit realm. And to live our lives to the full, we need to be conscious of the spirit realm, to learn to see what is invisible to our physical eyes and to learn to see with the eye of faith. And today's message is entitled, The Eye of Faith. Because there'll be frequent occasions in our lives where we'll face some sort of choice, either believing and acting on what we see or hear, or believing and acting on what we cannot see or hear, and rather, in that latter case, acting by faith, acting by reference to the eye of faith. So let's look at what the scriptures have to tell us about and reveal to us about this whole idea of having an eye of faith, learn to see things that cannot be seen with the physical eyes, because the scriptures have a lot to say about that. God knows that you and I need to learn to use other senses. If we're believers, if we want to relate to the spirit realm, there's something other than just the five physical senses, because there's a real world out there, a very real world out there that you and I cannot detect just with our physical senses. Look at 2 Kings chapter 6. If we turn first of all to 2 Kings chapter 6, and we read verses 8 through 20, quite an interesting story. 2 Kings and chapter 6, talking of some events in the life of Elisha, and we'll pick up in verse 8. And here we read, "Now the king of Syria was making war against Israel." Not much has changed in the last 2,500 years or so. "And he took counsel with his servant, saying, 'My camp will be in such and such a place.'" So he would plan to send his soldiers out to a particular area to lie in wait for the Israelites. Verse 9 tells us, "And the man of God," this is Elisha, "sent to the king of Israel, saying, 'Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there.' Then the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him, and thus he," Elisha, "warned him, and he was watchful there, not just once or twice." So Elisha kept advising the king of Israel, "Don't go there, send your guys out, be alert. The king of Syria is planning to be there." And so the Israelites always managed to avoid the danger. Verse 11, "Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, 'Will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? We've got a spy in the camp. Somebody here, one of us, is contacting the king of Israel and giving him our plans and our secrets.'" Verse 12, "And one of his servants said, 'None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel. He tells the king of Israel the words you speak in your bedroom. You have no secrets from the prophet. He knows what you're planning, and he advises the king.'" Verse 13, "So he said, 'Well, go see where he is, that I may send and get him.'" I think that means capture him, go and arrest him, drag him off. "And it was told him, saying, 'Well, surely he is in Dothan.' Therefore, he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city." So one imagines it's several thousands, at least, in this great army to go and capture the man of God. Verse 15, "And when the servant of the man of God rose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to Elisha, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?'" Because this looks, to the physical eye at least, rather grim. Here's armies, here's horsemen, here's chariots, here's swords, here's spears, and the servant will know what they're there for, because Elisha's been telling the secrets of the Syrians to the king of Israel, and here comes trouble. "What shall we do?" And verse 16, "Elisha answered, 'Do not fear, no problem, no problemo. For those who are with us are more than those who are with them.'" And you can understand why the servant might be just momentarily perplexed, thinking to himself, "Now, hold on a moment. Us, that's Elisha, and me, that's a 1 plus 1, that would be probably 2. And looking around the city, he says, "Well, that's probably 5,000 over there. and I think 5,000 over there, and probably 35,000 or whatever. But Elisha says, there's more of us than them. Now, was Elisha talking nonsense? Had Elisha been on his magic mushrooms for breakfast, having, you know, hallucinations? Well, no. Verse 17 tells us, Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Well, hold on a moment. The young man's eyes were open. That's how he'd seen the armies and the horses and the chariots. That's why he was frightened, because of what he could see. Why open his eyes? They're wide open already, probably goggling at all these soldiers with their swords and spears. But of course, Elisha is saying to God, please open his other eyes, the eyes of his spirit, that he may see what is not normally visible. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So suddenly the young man's eyes, which were open physically, are now opened in the spirit realm. And the young man can see, actually, there are horses and chariots and angelic army. Now, they were there before the young man's eyes were opened, but he could not see them. And to you and me today, there are things around us that we can't see, but they're just as real as the armies were here. Around you, around me, there will be angels. There may also be the other lot, the principalities, the powers, the demons. And you and I can learn to see them, not with our physical eyes, and I don't suppose we'd necessarily want to, but to come to comprehend that this is a real world that surrounds us. And the young man was privileged to see what was there all along, had been there. Elisha saw it, presumably with his eye of faith. Now the young man could see it. So there is this very, very real spirit realm. And if necessary, had it come to it, the chariots of fire would have paid pretty easily to the Syrians. Now, as it happens, that didn't come to pass. We can read the rest of the story, or at least part of it. Verse 18. So when the Syrians came down to him to capture him, no doubt, and cart him off in handcuffs and chains, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people, I pray, with blindness. And he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Elisha said to them, this is not the way, nor is this the city. You're in the wrong place, guys. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. But he led them to Samaria. Now, it says they've struck them with blindness. I think their eyes were still open. I think they could still see the horses they sat on and the path they rode along and the man going ahead of them, but it was all an illusion. Their eyes were open, but what they were seeing was not true reality. They thought they were being taken to find Elisha, but he was taking them by a different road. Verse 20. So it was when they had come to Samaria, the capital of Israel, that Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. Well, I'm sure their eyes were open, but they were not seeing reality any longer. Now their eyes are opened, and they saw, that they were inside Samaria, the Israelite capital, the enemy. So your eyes can be open to see. Your eyes can be open and you see not. You and I have to learn to see with the eye of faith. Now, of course, Israelites thought, well, we'll butcher them, shall we, now that they're here. But Elisha said, no, that's not what we're going to do. Let's have a big feast. Let's bring out the fatted calf, the oxen, the sheep, and let's have a wonderful feast for these soldiers. And it all ended pretty happily. It was a good outcome for a change. But notice that there are things that can be seen with the eye of faith. It's a real world, the spirit realm. It's not imaginary. It is absolutely real, and it's more real sometimes, you could say, than the world that you and I actually live in. You know, the seat you're sitting on might seem fairly real, unless, of course, you're lying in bed a bit early in the morning. If you're in America, perhaps you're lying there with your head back on your pillow listening to the sound. But whatever you are, you can probably feel something that feels real under you. But it's not as real as the real spirit realm. It's genuine. Let's turn to Numbers chapter 22. And we'll read some verses from 4 to 34, Numbers 22. Not read it all, but we'll read a selection of verses, Numbers 22, verses 4 through 34. Story of Balaam and his failed attempt to curse Israel. These are the days of Moses, and Israel has come out of ancient Egypt, making their way somewhat towards the promised land. And the Moabites are getting a bit uneasy at this vast number of Israelites who are approaching. So they want Balaam, the famous prophet, to curse them. So we pick up in verse 4. So Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this company," talking of Israel, "will lick up all that is around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field." And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. And he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Look," so Balaam is this very famous prophet, "Look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me. Therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So Balaam's obviously quite famous in this area, and Balak, the king of Moab, wants Balaam to come and curse these Israelites. And once they put the kibosh on them, then, you know, the Moabites can kick the stuffing out of them. This is the theory, at least. Dropping down to verses 12 and 13. "And God said to Balaam, 'You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed.'" Now, that should have been the end of the story, because God says, "No, don't go. These are blessed by me. You are not going to curse them." So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, who had arrived with some money, "Go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you." Now, Balaam was actually quite a covetous man, and he knew there was money available here if he was to respond to the Moabites' request. So he plays a little bit of a game, but dropping down to verses 20 onwards. "God came to Balaam at night and said to him, 'If the men come to call you, rise and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do.'" So Balaam had more or less said to them, "Look, you know, no matter how much money you give me," hint, hint, "the law's not going to allow me to come." So, of course, they read between the lines and they came back with more money. But God says, "If they come and call you, go with them." Now, in fact, God has said already, "Don't go. Don't think of cursing." But, you know, Balaam, in his heart, wanted to go. He wanted the money. He wanted the rewards of being a false prophet. And he itched to go, he desired to go. In a sense, God's going to give him a wee bit of a wriggle room here, enough rope to hang himself by. Now, it does say here in verse 20, "If the men come to call you, rise and go with them." Now, it's not at all clear that the men actually did come and call Balaam again. But verse 21 says, "Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab." So even if they didn't call, I think Balaam took the initiative, which, of course, he's not supposed to do. off he goes, because he knows he'll try and find some way of working this to his advantage and getting access to all the gold and silver that was promised. Then God's anger was aroused because he went, probably without the men actually asking him. And the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. And he, Balaam, was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. Now the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. So Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back onto the road. It's a lady donkey who sees an angel with a sharp-looking sword in his hand. And so the donkey says, "Oh, I'm getting out of here," into the field it goes, because Balaam does not see this. Verse 24, then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. Not much room to get past. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pushed herself against the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. So he struck her again. Then the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right or the left. You are trapped. An angel with a sword, no way past. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam's anger was aroused, and he struck the donkey with his staff. Now, Balaam couldn't see an angel, but the angel was there, and a donkey could see it. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you've struck me these three times?" And amazingly, Balaam has a conversation with his donkey. Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you really have thought, well, hang on a second, donkey talking to me? What's going on here?" But anyway, Balaam, obviously annoyed, simply says, "Because you've abused me, I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you." So the donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your donkey in which you've ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Was I ever disposed to do this to you?" And he said, "No," having this conversation with his donkey and obviously not quite catching on. "There's something a bit unusual here. My donkey's talking to me." Then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes. Well, now, Balaam's eyes were open. He saw his donkey. His ears were open. He's talking to his donkey. His foot's bruised from being crushed against the wall. Balaam's eyes are open, aren't they? Well, yes, physically, but no, not in the spirit realm. But now the Lord opens Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed his head and fell flat on his face, because a drawn sword is ready. It's not, you know, and it's a scabbard or whatever. It's out there. It's ready to be used. And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out to stand against you because your way is perverse before me. The donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would also have killed you by now and let her live." This is a narrow escape, and really Balaam owes his life to this donkey. And Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned, for I did not know you stood in the way against me. Now therefore, if it displeases you, I will turn back." But of course, his heart's still on the money, and the story carries on. But the interesting thing there is that, you know, here's a man who cannot see an angel with a drawn sword until his eyes are opened, and then he sees reality. Now, I know for myself, I wouldn't mind the ability to, you know, see literally the spirit realm. It might be a bit scary, but, you know, I'm curious as to what's out there. And I think it would be great in some ways if our actual physical eyes could be opened this way. We could see what's in the spirit realm. But that's not the way God normally works. God's greater purpose, and it is a greater purpose, other than these special occasions, is that you and I learn to live and walk by faith. that we learn to use the eye of faith and to learn to see the invisible, to see the invisible by faith. And that's more important to God than simply giving us a special ability now and then to see into the spirit realm. Be great if it happened, pretty exciting, I'm sure, but of more importance to God is that you learn and I learn to see with the eye of faith and to learn to walk by faith. Let's turn to Romans chapter 1 and read verses 16 and 17. Romans chapter 1. Romans 1, verses 16 and 17, just one phrase I'm going to get to here, but we'll introduce it in verse 16. Paul writes, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it, the gospel, is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first, and also for the Greek. For in it, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." Or some translations, "the righteous one shall live by faith." If you're a just person, if you're a righteous person, and all of us should be, then it says here that the just shall literally live by faith. And that's quite an important phrase there, because it appears three more times in Scripture. So that phrase actually is repeated four times in total. Once here, it also appears originally in Habakkuk, chapter 2 and verse 4. That's his very first appearance, Habakkuk 2 and verse 4. Paul also repeats it in Galatians 3:11. And the writer of Hebrews repeats it in Hebrews 10 and verse 38. So we can probably conclude it's a pretty important statement, because it appears once in the Old Testament and three times in the New Testament. The just, or the righteous, shall live by faith. Faith isn't just something that is an occasional add-on, something that's nice to have, but end of the day, if you don't have it, well, so what? It says we live by faith, just like we live by breathing. If you don't breathe, well, you won't be around very long. Without faith, we won't get very far, because the just person, the righteous person, will actually live their lives. They will live by faith. It says in verse 17, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. That really means by faith, from beginning to end. Faith is that important to you and to me, because we are to actually live by faith. Well, let's look at one of the key definitions of faith, which is in Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11 is the faith chapter, and Hebrews 11, 1 gives us, I think, a fairly well-known definition of what we mean by faith, because it says, "Now faith is..." And then it gives us a definition, just like in 1 John 3, it says, "Sin is," and then it gives us a definition. I think in John 5, it says, "For the love of God is," and then it gives us a definition. So here in Hebrews 11, 1, it says, "Now faith is." And what it is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things, notice, not seen. Faith is the substance of things which we hope for. We don't yet have them, but we hope for them. And it is the evidence of things not seen. Now, because something's not seen doesn't mean it doesn't exist. These things do exist, but they're not seen. They're not visible. And it says it's evidence. Other words sometimes you come across are proof. or conviction. Faith is the proof of things not seen. Faith is the conviction of things not seen, the evidence of things not seen. It's not vague language, this. It's not sort of wishy-washy. A couple of other translations that might help. One is the International Standard Version, the ISV, which translates this verse as, "Now faith is the assurance that what we hope for will come about, and the certainty that what we cannot see exists." That's a strong word, the certainty. Again, "Now faith is the assurance that what we hope for will come about, and it's the certainty that what we cannot see exists." Or we can think of perhaps the New Living Version, the NLV. "Now faith is being sure we will get what we hope for. It is being sure of what we cannot see." So sureness, assurance, certainty, proof, conviction. All strong words. It's not that faith is some, you know, vague, wishful thinking, you know, pie in the sky type of scenario. Faith is conviction. Faith is proof. Faith is evidence of things that we do not now see with our physical eyes, but are real. They do exist. We just don't see them yet with our physical eyes. Look at 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians 4, verses 16 to 18. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 to 18. Okay, picking up in verse 16. And here Paul's commenting on some of the difficulties that he and his team have faced in the real world. And he says, "Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction," you and I would probably find it severe affliction, but Paul has different standards, it seems, "for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we do not look at the things which are seen, but rather we look at the things which are not seen." We're looking at things which are not seen, which are not visible. But he says we are looking at them. Well, if they're not seen, he has to be using the eye of faith, because if he can see them, his physical eyes would be good enough. But you notice verse 18, "While we do not look at the things which are seen," that's not what we're focusing on, letting our eyes dwell on, "but rather we're looking at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, can be changed, but the things which are not seen are eternal." So Paul's saying, we are looking at things which are not seen. We are looking at invisible things. You know, Paul could see the things which are seen with his naked eyes. He could see troubles. He could see persecutors. He could see angry Jewish leaders. He could see rocks being thrown. He could feel the rocks landing on his body when he's being stoned. He could feel the rods beating his back. He could see and feel and taste the blood and all the rest of it. But he did not focus on these things. With the eye of faith, he looked at the things which are not seen. The spirit realm. God, the Lord Jesus, the angels, his eternal future. Paul relied on the eye of faith. He saw the invisible. And really, you and I must do the same. It's immaturity, really, to base our lives and our reactions purely on what we see or sense or feel or taste. You and I have to learn there are times when we have to walk by faith, by seeing the invisible. Look at 2 Corinthians 5, only just a few verses later, 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7, very short verse. And Paul's continuing the same theme here, really. He says, verse 7, "For we walk by faith, not by sight." We walk by faith, not by seeing. It's a bit like, I guess, if you were an aeroplane pilot, there'd be times when you would not be able to trust your eyes to determine how to fly your aeroplane. If you're in, thick fog, perhaps in heavy cloud cover, you might get disoriented. You've got your eyes, but all they can see is just this white fog. And your brain would be easily disoriented. Am I flying upright? Am I flying upside down? Am I pointing up? Am I pointing down? Which way's up and down? And that's when you have to have the confidence to fly by faith on your instruments. You look at all the dials and the gauges, and they'll give you information to fly by. And you can't fly by what your eyes might tell you, because they could be deceiving you. Or there's nothing to see. And in a sense, the Bible, the Word of God, is our instrument set. It's got dials and instruments, and it gives us information to fly our lives by. And there are times when it's not wise for you and I to walk by sight, to fly by sight. We have to learn to walk by faith, to fly by faith, to rely on the instruments that God has given us, the eye of faith. Look at Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, read verses 24 to 27. Hebrews chapter 11. And picking up in verse 24. This is the example of Moses, who had a choice to make, to rely on what he saw and felt and experienced, or to make a different choice. Verse 24, Hebrews 11. "By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward." According to Josephus, if he was accurate, Moses, as a younger man, was actually quite a famous general. He'd been raised in royalty, Pharaoh's daughter. He had a career, it seems, as a politician, as a leader. He apparently was a famous general in the Egyptian armies. He had fame. He had finances. But he didn't really look at and choose his life based upon what he saw. It says he looked to a different reward, but one actually he could not see, because notice verse 27, "By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he persevered, as seeing him who is invisible." So Moses saw him who is invisible. Well, how can you see him who's invisible? By the eye of faith. So he did not focus on the things that he could see, which things are temporary, changeable, but he focused on eternal values. And for Moses, it was a life-changing decision, was it not? And what did he have to show for it in the early years? Nothing. Because he fled Egypt. And for the next 40 years, which is quite a long time, 40 years is really a long, long time to be in the backside of the desert looking after a bunch of sheep. So here's this apparently famous general warrior raised in the royal family, and for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, sheep, more sheep, and more sheep. But he saw something that you cannot see, and he made a decision based upon what his eye of faith told him, not what he physically could see. And it was a good choice, of course. Ultimately, you know, he met Jehovah pretty much face to face, and of course Moses will be a great man in the world to come. Let's turn to Romans 4, read verses 16 to 22. Romans chapter 4. Here's an example of Abraham, who also learned not to rely on the physical evidence of his eyes, but to rely upon what you cannot see. In this case, the word of God, the promises of God. Even though there's nothing visible, you and I have to choose, will I rely on my eyes, my fantastic intellect and logical abilities, or will I choose to rely upon what I cannot see using my eye of faith? Well, Abraham made the right choice. We pick up the story in verse 16. Verses 16, 17, 18, more or less the introduction, but we'll read it anyway. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. And Abraham was a man of faith, as we'll see in a moment. As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations, in the presence of him whom he believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did, who, talking of Abraham, contrary to hope, in hope, believed. You know, physical hope gave you no hope, but thankfully Abraham had a different type of hope, a spiritual hope. It says that he became the father of many nations according to what was spoken, so shall your descendants be. You know, God had said, Abraham, your descendants will be as the stars of heaven, as the sand of the seashore in multitude. And Abraham believed that, even though there was no evidence. Verse 19, and not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body already dead, since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. So he had a choice, like you and I often have. He could say, well, hang on a second, this makes no sense. I'm 100 years old. Sarah, she's 90-odd. She's an old woman. I mean, Sarah was infertile when she was 20. Now she's 90. This is, oh, no, this can't happen. This can't work. I mean, no one's ever heard of a man and woman of this age having a child. This is just ridiculous. If he'd focused on what he saw, what he felt, you know, felt his own body, looked at the wrinkles around, you know, Sarah's eyes, he would have said, nope. You can't buck the evidence of your eyes. I can see, I can feel, I can touch. I know this cannot happen. But it says, verse 19, not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body or his environment, what was around him, in this case, you know, Sarah and her body. Verse 20, he did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God, and being, notice, fully convinced that what God had promised, he was also able to perform, and therefore it was accounted to him for righteousness. So Abraham had a choice. Do I rely on my physical eyes, my physical senses, my ears, my sense of touch, or do I rely on the promise of God, even in the absence of any physical evidence? Well, thankfully, he went with the eye of faith, the conviction of things not sin. And it probably wasn't easy for him, because if you think about it, 100 years old, an infertile wife who is 90 years old, I mean, really, this doesn't happen, does it? So, you know, it was a good example that Abraham, our father, left us. It was a real test. And he passed, of course, with flying colors. There's another, not such a great example, but one we can all learn from in John chapter 20. The Gospel of John chapter 20, we'll read verses 19 to 29. So John chapter 20. This is Thomas, Doubting Thomas, as he's known. I suppose a bit of a pity if that's how you've known the rest of your, well, not your life, of course, because you've been dead a long time. But, you know, in history, you're known as Doubting Thomas. You know, Abraham, father of the faithful. Doubting Thomas. Yep, not such a good outcome. Ultimately, picking up a story in John 20 and beginning in verse 19. This is just immediately after Jesus' resurrection, or the same day. It says, then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in the midst and said to them, peace be with you. Now when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. So the doors are shut and locked because they're a bit nervous about whether the Jews are after them next. And Jesus just appears, you know, through the solid walls, through the solid door, and he's just there, and he has a conversation, and it's great. But there's one person missing. Drop down to verses 24 to 29. But Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said to him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, put my finger into the print of the nails, put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Unless I see, I will not believe. This is the man from Missouri.
The Show Me State.
Unless I see it, I won't believe it. No, actually, not really very good on Thomas's part, because, well, two things at least. One is that Jesus already explained in earlier years that he would be crucified and dead 3 days and three nights and would be resurrected. So clearly Thomas didn't believe his master. But then, not that the rest of the apostles either for that matter. But then here, he's got 10 of his buddies. Peter's there. John's there. James, they're all saying, we all just saw the Lord. He turned up and he said this and this and this. So Thomas not only disbelieves what he'd heard Jesus say, you know, months earlier, he doesn't even believe his own fellow apostles. So a really pretty stubborn guy. Verse 26, after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas this time was with them. Jesus came, the doors being shut, and once again stood in the midst and said, peace to you, shalom. And then he said to Thomas, Thomas? You will probably imagine Thomas is just sort of shrinking to the perhaps the far corner of the room at this point, where it might be a bit darker over there. Perhaps the candles aren't quite as bright. Thomas, reach your finger here and look at my hands. Reach your hand here. Put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. And Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said to him, Thomas, because you have seen me, you've believed. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. You know, Thomas was a man who was totally reliant on his 5 physical senses. If I can't see him, if I can't touch him, I won't believe. I only believe in what I see with my eyes, the physical evidence. That's the human philosophy, isn't it? Seeing is believing. Well, Jesus said, actually, the reverse is true. Believing is seeing. You need to believe first, and then you'll see. And so Thomas is a good example of a bad example. We have to learn to see and trust in what we cannot see. One of my favorite examples is in Mark chapter 5, verses 25 to 34. So Mark 5, this is a lady with the issue of blood. Great story for lots of different reasons, but picking up in Mark chapter 5, and verse 25. Because here's a lady that saw, believed, without any physical evidence. And she did that without half the benefits that you and I have got. We've got the whole Bible we can read and learn from. This lady had comparatively little, but she'd heard enough to believe. Picking up in verse 25. Now, a certain woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. So that's a long time, you know, 12 years to have this this hemorrhage, probably leaving her quite weak and certainly, you know, deemed to be unclean in that society. And she suffered, it says, many things from many physicians, all with her, you know, crackpot ideas as to what to do to get better. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. So now she was got a hemorrhage, she was unclean, now she was broke and actually getting worse. So really, from a physical point of view, there's not much going for this lady. When she heard about Jesus, and who knows what she heard, but clearly it was enough, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, for she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." So she leaves her home, and that's probably quite dangerous for her because she's out in public as an unclean person. If she'd been spotted earlier, there'd be issues. If she stayed at home, she'd probably have died. So, you know, it's a brave thing to do. But she just says, verse 20, "If I can just touch his garments, I will be made well." That's a very powerful statement of faith. I'll just have to touch his garments and I'm going to be healed. And immediately, verse 29, the fountain of her blood was dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. Instant. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "Huh? You see the multitude thronging you, and you're saying, 'Who touched me?' I mean, Jesus, Lord, Master, there's at least 50 people touching you at this very moment." And he looked round to see her who had done this thing. So Jesus apparently, you know, didn't make a decision here that she's fit to be healed. She merits healing. Jesus wasn't, in that sense, terribly involved. The lady drew on his healing power by her faith. And she's saying, "Who did that? Somebody around here has been healed. I know it. I felt the power leave me. Who was it? Step forward, whoever you are." And the woman, verse 33, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." Interesting. Your faith has healed you. Your faith. Now, she had 12 years of sickness, 12 years of getting worse, 12 years of everything she tried, every doctor she visited, it got worse and worse, incurable by the sound of it. But she chose not to consider her own body, now almost dead, so just like Abraham, and she looked at something she could not see. She saw herself healed. She saw herself restored to good health. And all she had was just, you know, some part of the story that Jesus of Nazareth was a man who brought healing. And she believed it because she said, "If I can touch his garments, I will be healed." What evidence does she have? Only the word. Only the trust. And you and I, of course, have got far more information than this lady had. We've got the entire New Testament scriptures plus the Old. So that's a pretty powerful example. Let's see another one in Matthew 14, verses 22 to 31. Matthew 14, story of Peter and his adventures on the Lake of Galilee. Matthew 14, beginning verse 22, see how Peter responds to the word, the promise, the instructions of God versus what he might see or feel with his physical senses. There'll be a conflict here. How does Peter react? Verse 22, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain by himself to pray. When evening had come, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, that's somewhere around about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, Jesus went to them walking on the sea, which of course is what you do if you miss the boat. You just walk over the sea. Fairly straightforward. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it's a ghost. And they cried out for fear. Brave fishermen. But I guess we might do just the same. And immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, be of good cheer. It's me. Do not be afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So there's always been that belief that Peter sort of, speaks first before engaging his brain. And perhaps this is another example of that. He just blurts out, if that's you, if that really is you, command me to come to you on the water like you're doing. So Jesus thought to himself, well, it is me, I suppose. So, okay, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. How can you do that? How can you walk on water? Well, Jesus was doing it. Then you say, that's because Jesus is Jesus. But here's Peter doing it. Peter is walking on the water because he is Jesus' word. Peter, come. And so Peter is on the water, walking towards Jesus. We don't know how long this lasted, whether it was 5 seconds, 20 seconds, a minute. But Peter's walking on the water. But then he starts to sink, and you think, well, now what changes here? Is Jesus any different? Nope. Is the wind any different than it was? No. Are the waves any different than they were when Peter first stepped down? No. Everything is the same, really. Nothing's changed apart from Peter is going to change. Because notice, verse 30, but when Peter saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, because we all know in boisterous winds you can't walk on water. Well, of course, the wind's got nothing to do with it, has it? You can't walk in water in any circumstances other than if Jesus gives you the word. So the wind was irrelevant. But it says Peter saw the wind, and no doubt Peter felt the spray in his face and could taste the water on his lips and his beard and so on, and he could feel it buffeting. And Peter considered not the promise of God, but Peter looked at his environment, his surroundings, what he could see, what he could hear, what he could feel, what he could taste. And then he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? So Jesus wasn't actually very impressed. And the other apostles might have been thought, oh, look, Peter's walking on the water. Oh, no, he's not. He's gone under. And you might think, well, I'm not going to blame Peter, because, you know, he got out of the boat and he did start walking. So, only the first person other than Jesus to walk on water. But Jesus was not impressed. He says, oh, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? Because Peter had the word to rely on. But But rather than walking by faith, Peter walked by sight and sound and hearing and taste and feeling and all the rest of it. And that's not what Jesus is looking for in people like Peter or you or me. Look at Hebrews 11:6. Hebrews 11:6. All of us want to, well, I imagine all of us want to please God. I would think that's got to be expected of us all. But it says here, verse 6, without faith, it is impossible to please God. It doesn't say it's difficult. It says without faith, you can't do it. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, that he's there, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So you and I should believe God is and believe that God responds, that God is a rewarder of those who come to him. Those who come to him diligently, it says, seeking. But without faith, it's going to be pretty tricky to please God. So you and I, it says the just shall live by faith. You and I want to be people of faith, who live by faith, who walk by faith, not by sight. Because that's one way that we can ensure that we're pleasing to God, that we take his word and trust his word over and above our five physical senses. If there's a conflict, we choose the word of God, not what our ears tell us or our eyes tell us. Let's look at Mark chapter 11, read verses 12 to 14 to start with. This is the incident of the fig tree which got cursed. Mark 11, starting in verses 12 through 14, just gives us the background of what took place the day before Jesus' explanation. So here in verse 12 it says, now the next day, when they had come out from Bethany, Jesus was hungry. And seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. In response, Jesus said to it, let no one eat fruit from you ever again. And his disciples heard it. Now you might think, well, so what? Well, hang on for a moment. Just think about this. Jesus is talking to a fig tree. Is that usual? Do we normally converse with trees? Plants? Well, actually, sometimes we do. Yeah. You know, if your car doesn't work, you might give it a good kick and say, you sorry specimen, you know, give it another kick. Why don't you ever work for me, kick, kick? People hit TVs and say, work, come on, work. I want to see that, you know, that program. And they hit the TV on the top and shout at it. People do talk to inanimate things, but here's Jesus talking to a fig tree and he says, that's it. Nobody will ever eat fruit from you again, that's for sure. And his disciples heard him speaking out loud to a fig tree. Dropping down to verse 20. Now in the morning, the next morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, remembering, said to Jesus, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away. Now, it didn't wither immediately, because this was 24 hours later. Probably what happened was that underground, under the soil where the roots were, it had started to shrivel up, but it may have taken a few hours for the leaves to start, you know, sagging and then dropping off. So a day later, it's evident this fig tree is dead. And Jesus answered and said to them, have faith in God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will come to pass, he will have whatever he says. So Jesus said to a fig tree, die, and it did. And Jesus says, whoever, not just me, Jesus, because I'm the Lord, he said, verse 23, assuredly, verily, I'm saying to you, whoever, that's like pretty wide open, Whoever says
with his mouth
to this mountain, shift, and doesn't doubt, but believes, he will have whatever he says. Whatever he opens his mouth and says, if he believes what he says. Verse 24, therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you will have them. When you pray, believe that you receive them, and there may be a gap, you will have them. You have to believe first before you receive. The receiving comes after the believing. The believing comes before the receiving. You believe, and then you see. Believing is seeing, not vice versa. It's important, notice here, that you have to believe you receive them when you pray. You believe when you pray. You don't wait to receive them and then you believe you've got them. It doesn't take much belief to believe you've got something that's sitting in front of you.
Yep.
A couple of other translations we could look at. The RSV says here in verse 24, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. So notice, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. The believing comes first. Faith is the conviction of things not seen. Remember? The faith comes first. The faith is the substance of things hoped for. You hope because it's still in the future, but your faith is the conviction right there and then that you have it. The New American Standard Bible of verse 24 says, all things which you pray or ask, believe that you have received them and they will be granted you. So all things which you pray or ask, believe that you have received them, and time passes, perhaps, and they will be granted you. The believing comes first. Then comes the receiving. And there might be a gap of a minute, an hour, a month, a year, 10 years, who knows? But you and I have to believe that we've received, even though there's nothing yet to see. We have to see it done with the eye of faith. Even though there's nothing physically to see. And if we say, well, nothing seems to have happened, well, I don't suppose God answered that prayer. Well, in that case, we didn't believe that we received, did we? Faith is our proof, our evidence of things not yet seen. We don't wait to receive and then say, oh, no, I believe I've got it. When we pray, we must believe we have received when we pray. Look at Matthew 21. And verses 20 to 22, Matthew 21, is the same passage, just the way that Matthew's explained it or recorded it. Matthew chapter 21. Matthew 21. And verses 20 to 22. Now, when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, well, how did the fig tree wither away so soon? Because it, you know, obviously it surprised them. They'd heard Jesus speak to it. And Jesus answered and said to them, assuredly, I say to you, if you have faith, some people think, well, hang on, Jesus can do this. Because Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus has all this power. Jesus can do, he can walk in water. He can feed 5,000. He can cleanse lepers. Jesus can raise the dead because he's Jesus. But nobody else can do that. That's quite a common view. Only Jesus. But then, if that's the case, how do we interpret Jesus' words? Because he says here, assuredly, verily, truly, I say, to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, you can do that as well, but also, in addition to that, if you say to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, it will be done. Now, I think that's, he's using it as an example. Yeah, a mountain, I don't think there's any reason why I would particularly need to move any mountains, but it's just an example. Even this mountain, if you spoke to it and believed, it would move. In reality, there's many things in your life and my life that we would like to move away, or potentially to move toward us. All right? Things in your life which are obstacles, and they're between you and where you believe you ought to be. Or perhaps you want a mountain or some situation to move towards us. Jesus says, we can not only do what was done to the fig tree, speak to it and it dies, but we can speak to anything right up to, and at least figuratively speaking, including a mountain, and it will be done. Verse 22, and all things, whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. It's not whatever you ask in prayer you will receive. You know, the ingredient that sometimes we seem to omit is believing. Well, believing even though there's no physical evidence, even though there's nothing visible to see, but you and I have to learn to see the invisible. It's real. It's not imaginary. Faith, remember, is the proof, the evidence, the conviction of things not seen, or at least not yet seen. So whatever we ask in prayer, if we believe, then we'll receive. Now, there's no, it doesn't take much believing to say, well, I'll wait till I have the evidence, till I see it and I can touch it, and then I'll believe. There's no belief required there. And we might have a rather long wait if that's where we're going to approach it. And of course, we've said before in other messages, there's no point just praying more frequently and endlessly the same prayer over and over and over again. That suggests we didn't believe we received when we prayed. There's no point getting a really sort of a email chain going of trying to get hundreds ganging up in God, storming gates of heaven, all that stuff, even fasting. Not that we do that very often, of course, but you know, the ultimate, I'll fast to try and move God. It's the believing that makes a difference. God's faith, even as small as a mustard seed, Jesus said, would move mountains. So you and I have to learn to see through the eye of faith. Now, all of us are pretty experienced of conducting our lives by the five physical senses. If you're driving a car, it's good if you've got eyeballs to see with. Walking down a street, good to have ears so you can hear what's happening around you. You and I are used to relying on our five physical senses, and that's good. For much of our daily lives, our five physical senses are absolutely fundamental, and that's why God gave them to us. And if we lose one, you know, lose an eye in an accident or whatever, then to some extent we're a little bit handicapped. But we can't, in every situation, choose to rely on the physical evidence, because there is a real spirit realm. There are angels, there are demons, there are spiritual forces, there are promises of God. And you and I have to somehow, in our lives, learn to walk by faith. To learn to walk by the conviction of things not yet seen. There is something called the eye of faith, and it's important that you and I, if you like, take up the challenge of Scripture and learn to walk by faith. It's an important challenge, and it's one that pays benefits. Someday it might be a matter of life and death. So it's a topic we're going to continue for at least a week or two. For now, we'll leave it there, and we'll pick up the story again this time, next week. So that's it for now.